I think we should start with the most obvious question.
Yes.
I don't know if you can remember the second season of Man vs. Wild.
Yeah.
With Bear Grylls.
Yeah.
He visited Namibia in that episode.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep in mind, this is a guy who regularly drinks his own urine.
Mm.
On that show, I've only seen him completely gag and throw up once.
Mm.
And that was in Namibia.
Yeah.
And he made tea from the droppings of a dasi.
Okay.
And he just boiled it up,
yeah,
and completely gagged. So apparently this actually tastes worse than the urine of a human being.
Yeah.
So having been to Namibia, did you have a chance to try that?
No, what I did is I didn't boil a dasi's droppings. I boiled a dasi. And I had that for dinner.
That's much nicer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, boiled dasi is much nicer than urine.
Okay, so like a shaman returning from a walkabout,
mm-hmm,
our features editor Gerard Horn has emerged from the desert of Namibia.
Yeah.
He's a little older, a little wiser.
A little bit grayer.
And he's here to share his wisdom with us.
Yeah.
So tell us just briefly how the trip came about, what it was.
It was basically Reno sponsors a reality cooking show that I've never heard of before. It's called Ultimate Braai Master. I don't know if you've seen it.
I've seen
Have
it.
Seen it? Mm. I'm the only person in South Africa who hasn't seen it. yeah, they sponsor the vehicles and it's entering its third season now.
I saw bits of the second
filming,
season.
Yeah, third season now. And they obviously sponsor the vehicles. The contestants drive around in, and if you win, I think you win 500,000 rand and now Renault's latest SUV, the Duster. So we basically set off to Namibia to go see
it. And you get to call yourself the Ultimate Braai Master.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was, my car had this awesome sticker that said Ultimate Braai Master. So I felt so good until I saw that the other journos who went as well also had dusters with Ultimate Braai Master written on them. But, you know, it felt good for a few minutes. Yeah, so we head to, so we went to Namibia.
Essentially to Braai.
To Braai, yeah, to drive a duster to every single, place. I've never been there before. We did 2,800 kilometers on gravel.
Nice.
To test the duster, and we ate a lot of food.
Braai Flakes.
I guess, not only Braai Flakes, but everything. Braai Flakes I probably ate the most. So
boiled dusty.
Yeah, so I took a boiled dusty, which was nice.
For animal loving,
yeah,
listeners, let's just confirm that that's not actually true.
No, that's not true.
He's lying.
Yeah. No, I couldn't find a dasi. No, dasis are way too cute to eat. We basically went on a culinary adventure through Namibia.
culinary adventure.
Yeah.
Which sounds very exciting.
Yeah. It's because in Namibia, they don't have a lot of, anything basically except sand. They've got a lot of sand.
Visiting China, I think that can legitimately be called a culinary adventure.
Yeah, but in Namibia, they've got bread and
and the normal stuff we have.
Yeah,
did you eat game?
I did. The first place we stayed at was the Sausage Fillet Lodge, which is it's sort of a tourist thing.
A lot of European tourists.
A lot of European, a lot of Germans, a lot of Americans. And you sort of, it's a fairly lonely place, and you stand in a queue, and they've got these trays full of all the game you can possibly imagine. And then you stand in the queue, and you say, I want a little bit of Gemsbok, and you stand there, and the person actually buys it for you in front of you. And you can't believe how this amuses the foreign tourists. It's amazing.
I
was just standing there in the back of the queue being annoyed, because, you know, I just want some Braai Flakes.
So what did you have?
I had everything. The opportunity was there, so I gave everything a chow down.
Which was?
Gemsbok? All of the bokke. Gemsbok, springbok, waterbok. every kind of bok you can imagine I had. Vlakvark.
Is that good?
Yeah, it was all quite good. Like,
isn't it tough? It looks tough.
Yeah, no, it's all the game was tough.
Mm.
Like, it's insane. And I had the normal. I had some beef. I had some lamb. I had some pork.
No, big five.
I had everything. No, I didn't eat the big five. So I think if you stand there in the queue and you go, like, give me a lime chop, please, you probably get chucked out of there. Those people are insane about conservation.
Okay, so you did a lot of eating.
I did a lot of eating, yes.
And then a lot of driving. So who was the convoy? Who went with you?
It was actually interesting because there was only one other motoring person there from SA 4x4. The rest were travel and food journalists.
Okay.
Yeah, which were quite cool. I met an American lady who stays in South Africa now. She, I think her website is called Milk and Cookies SA. And she's a big food critic. It's awesome hanging out with her. And she was the big foodie amongst all of us.
And her first time in a manual.
In a manual car. It was the third time she was in a manual. And, you know, she did surprisingly well. Given, you know, the circumstance of driving on a gravel road at high speed.
And the contestants of the show, did you deal with them at all? Or the presenters? And
We chatted to them and I met a few of the contestants. And
so were they part of the convoy as well? Or?
No.
Oh, okay.
No,
so they...
we traveled for 3 days. And then finally on the third day, they made us some lunch.
Oh, okay. So
it was, we traveled through Namibia.
And apart from Sauces Flay, where were you?
I was at Sauces Flay. You know, quite of the few places were in the middle of nowhere, so I had no idea where I was at that point.
Because this is your first time to Namibia, hey?
First time to Namibia, and I now understand that, you know, in Namibia, distance is a relative term.
Oh, yes.
Like, when somebody tells me, oh, we're not far now, I think, oh, well, we're within 10 kilometers where we want to be. And when you ask a Namibian, listen, how far is Kermanswap from here? And they go like, oh, it's not far, about 180 Ks.
Oh, yes.
Those guys do insane distances.
They do.
So, yeah. But, mostly in the middle of nowhere, southern Namibia, into the desert at Sauces Flay.
Did you climb the...
I did. I was
dune?
On top of the dune. What a mission. You stand at the bottom and you think, oh, well, it's a big heap of sand. How hard can it be to get to the top? Oh, my word.
Yes.
It's one of the toughest things I've ever done. Because it's sort of deceptive, a dune. Because it looks small.
Mm.
But it takes you 5 steps to just
and
get
you just
a meter.
Sink in every time and slide back. It's terrible.
And the sun is coming down on you. No, it's rough.
I almost climbed it once, but then...
You gave up.
I didn't even start. I was like,
no.
I wanted to. Everyone was like, let's go. And then I decided, no.
Yeah. But
I've climbed a dune before in my life, and it really... It wasn't worth it at the end.
We had the opportunity to climb 2 dunes.
Well,
the big one, I think it's Dune 45, isn't it? Or is it Dune 43? It's either Dune 43 or Dune 45. I'm not 100% sure. And then another one in Sauces Flay, which looks out on the Dead Valley.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
That is beautiful.
You always see those pictures online as well with the dead trees and the pan in the front.
It's fantastic.
Beautiful.
And... I climbed the first one and we got to the second one. They asked me, do you want to climb this one? So I said, no, you know what? I think dunes are better appreciated from down here at the bottom.
Absolutely.
Like, because from up there, you can't see the dune itself.
Or if you can drive up one. Did you do some dune driving at all? Or?
No, but we did some soft sand driving.
That's cool.
Which I didn't think the duster would be able to do, but we made it through.
Good. So let's talk about the duster a little bit. So
yeah,
how did it perform? And... I saw from the pictures there were a couple of modifications on it.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Tell us a bit about it.
Well, the only difference between our duster we get in South Africa, and I'm talking about the 1.5 DCI four-wheel drive model. Mm.
Which is the only one we get.
It's the top-of-the-line one
in
South Africa. It's the same one they get in Namibia, except the one in Namibia becomes standard with a bull bar.
Okay, that nudge bar thing at the front.
Yeah, I was sort of laughing, you know, you put like one of those things on a serious off-roader. But then later on that day, it became apparent why they put it on there when we drove into a deer. I wasn't driving at that point. I just want to point out, like, it wasn't me who killed the bock.
So what happened?
It was just we were running late because some few modifications still had to be made on the Dusters we were supposed to be driving.
Mm.
They put a few things on, like a roof rack, some...
With a jerry can, I think,
with jerry cans, yeah, mm. And some radios. So we were delayed for 2 hours at the Renault dealership. So the result was we only arrived at our destination at 10 o'clock that night, mm. which meant we had to drive about 3-4 hours in the dark. And I mean, the dark over there is, it's properly dark. No street lights, no mm. nothing. All you have is the lights of your car.
And you never know when something just is going to run across the road. That's what makes it
no
so dangerous.
No fencing whatsoever. Mm. And I mean, the deers get spooked by the headlamps. Mm. So, and it's so impossible to brake for them because all you see is like a second before you hit it is the eyes. And just one just ran in front of the car and my co-pilot couldn't swing out in time. And so we...
What kind of speed were you doing?
Oh, guess about 80 kilometers an hour.
Jeez, the car actually looks surprisingly good based on the pictures I saw.
Yeah, well, it was just the plastic on the bumper was bent a little bit and the fog light was pushed into the car. But other than that, it was... fine.
And you kind of just nudged it on the side. It wasn't like a full frontal
impact. Just nudged on the side.
Because that would have done serious damage.
Yeah, no, we checked afterwards and it was dead on impact. So there was no suffering or anything. It was just dive straight over it. So, yeah,
sure.
That was a bit sad. But first day driving was a bit difficult. We didn't check the tire pressures before we left. So, obviously, those...
They were a bit hard.
They were a bit hard, and on those gravel surfaces, that dusty gets so skittish, you know. I mean, it's not the car's fault. It was... we didn't check the tire pressures. And even... Well, it gave me the opportunity to actually see what happens in a duster when you push it beyond the limit.
Mm.
And it's quite easy to control in an oversteer situation. So, okay. It's not really an issue.
And did you just drive it in locked four-wheel drive, or...?
Yeah, but actually, in the beginning, I drove it in four-wheel drive lock, but it automatically disengages when you're going over 100 kilometers
an hour.
Oh, really?
So that's not an option.
Yeah, and, but I found that if you leave it in automatic, where it automatically activates four-wheel drive, when it detects slip, is, that's more than good enough.
Okay.
More than enough for driving on a gravel road.
So what did you make the tire pressures?
Well, the second day after we spent like 4 hours driving in the dark with a skittish car and over a deer, whatever, we lowered the tire pressures to 1 bar because we were heading into Sauce's Flame.
Oh, so it was the real sand. Okay.
Yeah. And they really got to test like, driving into Sauce's Flame is all tar road until you get to a specific point and it says 4x4s only. And, we just sort of assumed, well, we can do it. And,
we're in a 4x4.
Exactly. So we missioned in there in the auto setting, and that didn't work at all. And so we locked it in four-wheel drive and set off again, which didn't work again at all.
Does it have traction control that you can switch off? Or?
That was the main issue. The traction control isn't that sophisticated.
Mm.
Like, if it starts slipping or anything, it just cuts the power immediately, which is exactly what you don't want in that situation. So... four-wheel drive lock with the traction control switched off, third gear all the way. It was fantastic.
Oh, wow. So,
and once we arrived on the other side, it was sort of, it was Isuzu double cab 4x4s and Hiluxes and Land Cruisers and whatever. And the Oaks all came down from the dune and they were like, how did you get this car here? There's no way you could get it here. What's going on? Is this a joke or what? And I said, no, seriously, I drove this car in here. It made it all the way. Because they thought it was like some publicity stunt for Brian Master. No, I actually drove this car, yeah.
It's like they say, it's not about the gun, it's about the gunner.
Yeah. I think, motivation levels were high, so I got that duster in there. There's actually this one cool woman who's a Leisure Wheels reader, if I can recall correctly, his name was Gustav. And he said he just bought a new Ford Cougar a couple of months back. And he read about what it's like in Namibia and what it is to get into Sauce's Flay and whatever. So he decided he was going to leave his cougar at home, fly in, rent one of those 4x4s, you know, you get in a Namibia with a tent and all of that stuff.
Mm.
And he actually asked me if I thought his cougar would make it in there, you know, because
obviously
I drove my Duster in there. So it's just like, well, I don't know.
That
like,
thing's impressive, though. I'm sure it would.
Yeah, I think you'd get it in there as well.
The kind of all-wheel drive system it has, it's really impressive.
Yeah.
It just has quite low-profile tires, so I think that might be an issue. Yeah. You can't drop that too much, but I think you could do it.
I think you don't really need ground clearance there. Mm. I mean, it's more a case of being able to maintain momentum and having four-wheel drive.
Mm.
And if you can just keep it going, I think you'd be fine.
Mm.
There's no place where you actually need the ground clearance as much. Mm. So I just think four-wheel drive would be more than enough to get it in there.
We did a trip a couple of years ago to Damaraland, kind of the beginning of the north of Namibia.
Mm.
And it's a lot of dry riverbeds. So obviously loads of loose sand and that sort of thing. And it was just a compact SUV trip. It was everything from kind of your harder compact SUVs like a Freelander or a Jeep Cherokee, all the way to a RAV4, Mitsubishi Outlander.
Mm.
Just a whole convoy of pretty much every compact SUV you can think of. And they did amazingly well. I mean, as long as you've got all-wheel drive in sand, you can do well. You don't need, like you said, the ground clearance and that sort of thing. It's fine. The only issue was that we had the same thing where some of those vehicles, you actually can't disengage the traction control.
Mm.
So that makes it a hell of a pain. It just bogs down the whole time, but apart from that, they're surprisingly capable.
Mm.
People tend to think if I want to go overlanding to Namibia or Botswana, that sort of place, I need a Hilux or a cruiser or something like that. But you can get surprisingly far with these compact SUVs.
Mm. And the Duster is ideally suited to those gravel roads in Namibia. I mean, like, if ever there was a place to destroy a car, I mean, that's it. I mean, those gravel roads work the car hard.
And a nice thing about the Duster is that it does have decent profile tires.
Yeah, it does.
So many of these compact SUVs, and like I said with the Cougar, they're built for tar, they're low profile, so you're going to lose tires.
Oh, yeah.
But with that one, it's got a chunky tire that can actually
do it. We took so many spare tires because we knew those roads are notorious for just slashing through tires. And I think we lost 2 tires. Our car didn't lose a single tire, but in the convoy, we lost a grand total of 2 tires.
Yeah, which isn't bad.
Yeah. So, it did very well.
Sometimes it's just luck. I mean, I did a different trip to Sossus Vlei once, and it was a whole convoy of Hiluxes, Rangers, BT50s, all the double cab buckies. But I was in a Nissan X-Trail, which also quite low profile tires. And I think there were 3 or 4 buckies that lost tires, and we didn't lose a single one. And it's just sometimes you get lucky, but you can't take the risk of not taking.
No,
if you want to go to Namibia on your own, you need at least 2.
Yeah.
2 spare tires, I'd say.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good idea to go to Namibia by yourself. While we were driving on our way actually to Ultimate Brimaster, we came across the wreck of a Toyota Prado, which burned down. And, you know, the owners just sort of left it there.
Yeah, what can you do?
I mean, if a piece of road defeats that car, you need to be so careful out there.
No, it's true, because of it's so vast, the distances, and there's just nothing around you. Like, you go up the Skeleton Coast, or you go to Piros, or some of those places right in the north, and you're really in the middle of nowhere. If something goes wrong, there's no help around, nothing. Yeah. So it's a dangerous place in that sense, that it's one of the greatest places to visit purely from the perspective of wanting to be on your own and wanting real solitude, because there are very few places in the world that you can still get that kind of solitude where you sit somewhere and you feel like you're the only person on earth.
Yeah, no, it's so peaceful out there. I actually was wondering how people get around there, and it turns out the car is like a secondary means of transport. Most of the farm owners, they use small airplanes to get around.
I can imagine, it's just
all over the mountains.
Such vast distances.
Yeah, all over the mountains you can just see these markers put there for the plane. So I can just look out of the window and see, oh, okay, cool, I'm near Sossus Vlei, sweet.
We did a story years ago
on
his name's Derek Lategan. He
runs
African Outdoor. And he did a whole trip through the whole of Namibia in his plane.
Mm.
He had a support vehicle and just flew the whole length of it.
Yeah. Every single lodge we visited while we were there, we slept over for, I think, 4 nights. Every single lodge has an airfield where people just fly in, sort of like that's how they roll
that's
over
how
there.
They do, yeah.
And, it was fantastic. One thing I can tell you is that, I mean, the deer over there are absolutely insane. When we came across that Prado wreck, we were walking around it and we actually saw deer droppings where a deer consumed part of the car, like the plastic from the dashboard or something. And it was just wedged into the droppings. Like, those deer are insane. It's
like one of the most inhospitable environments. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, it's so devoid of human life.
Mm.
Like, there's nobody else there but you for, I would guess, 200 kilometers in every direction.
Mm. I mean, if you go to the north, like the Kahukaland, it's such an amazing experience because it's not, you're not in a park. You're just on a national road and you might see elephant, lion, whatever, like Piros, the campsite there. It's renowned for the fact that it's built on one of the main paths that the wild elephants tend to use. So it's amazing. You can just be sitting in front of your tent and they start coming through.
Mm.
It's a magical place, like unlike any other.
Mm. And I loved Namibia. It was, the people there are so friendly and, it's just like, it's like South Africa, but just with more open spaces. And I don't want to say it's South Africa is still beautiful, but Namibia is beautiful in its own way.
Like very
the Fish River Canyon is magnificent and, there's a lot to see there. If you haven't been to Namibia, you should definitely make a plan and go.
And even places like, say, Walvisbaai or Swakopmund, they make the desert so accessible. It's literally like the dunes are right next to the highway. You can't believe it. So it's a nice, easy way to start overlanding if maybe going to Botswana or Mozambique, one of these places, is a bit intimidating. Like, Namibia is a good start because you're still in a country that's a lot like your own. It's very recognizable.
Yeah.
It's very friendly, so it's a great place
to
start out.
You can use rand. And you don't need to make any modifications to your car. All I'd say is just buy like maybe 3 extra spare tires and just load them on the back of your bucky, just in case.
Just in case.
Otherwise, you know, the people there were so nice. You have to think of Namibia in a specific context, because it's not like the cities aren't that big. I mean, even Windhoek is
relatively
about the size
small.
Of Middelburg. Yeah. Our medic that traveled along with us, Charles Pierce, magnificent man. He was telling us about even something like an emergency response vehicle, which in Johannesburg, I mean, they use Corollas or Golf GTIs or something.
Whatever, yeah.
This is, in Namibia, you have to build specific response vehicles. Their ambulances are based on the single cab Hilux 4-liter V6. You know, like the big.
So is that what you drove on this trip as well? Or?
No, you drove a Duster with us with his medical kit and whatever in there. But he says that's like his daily drive is a Hilux. Nice. Can you imagine being in a crash and then they throw you in the back of a bucky? And then, I suppose. I mean, that's how life is that side.
Mm. It's interesting, though, because I was chatting to one of these guides a while ago.
Mm.
And he said it's just reality that you lose people on trips.
Mm.
Because very often it's older people that have the time and the money to go on these guided trips that take a week or 9 days or whatever.
Mm.
And if you go up the Skeleton Coast, there's no emergency response around, really.
Yeah.
If someone gets a heart attack there,
it's done.
It's going to be too late by the time someone arrives. So it's quite an intimidating feeling when you're in the middle of nowhere and you realize there's
something's
no
wrong.
Support here.
Well, our medic told us one of the big mistakes oaks make. While I was at the airport waiting to fly back to South Africa, I read one of the magazines in the departure lounge, and they had some insanely interesting statistics about their death rate and accidents and whatever. 76% of accidents in Namibia are rollovers on the gravel roads, like cars that...
Yes, just like a completely different kind of environment.
You've been there before. You know, sort of, if you drive on those gravel roads, you just come up on this crest.
It's like a roller coaster. It's just
no idea what's going on the other side. And you can't slow down for everyone, because it would take you 3 days to drive to your next destination. That's so you just problem. Sort of... You drive over it at 120, because you can actually do 120 on a gravel. You have to say the gravel roads are insanely neat.
And nice and wide as well.
Yeah, there's loads of runoff. And I mean, it's Namibia. Even if you go off the road, there's nothing you're going to hit except like a sandbank or whatever. But anyways, then you go over one of these things and all of a sudden, it's not straight on the other side. There's like a right turn and you...
Yeah. And also, like, you never know. You could be doing 120 and the road's perfect, but then there's just a donga or something and all of a sudden you're in trouble.
Yeah. Or like a patch of soft sand and you could just feel the car getting skittish.
And but you can't go 80 or 60. Yeah. The distances are so vast, it'll take you forever. So you just have to drive.
Our medic told us one of the big problems they have is people, because obviously the more south you go, the more remote everything becomes. Like, there's almost nothing out there. And no fencing whatsoever, just a gravel road that stretches on for miles and miles. And then you see on the side of the road beautiful mountains. And they say they have a problem with oaks going like, well, there's nobody here, I'm tired, so I might as well camp. So they mission into just... Wherever to go camp on a mountainside. And obviously that's the sand there is so soft and you get stuck and it's literally a case of a car only comes by once a day, maybe. So, and then you're stuck there and nobody's looking for you, nobody knows where you are. So if you're going to Namibia, stick to the roads.
Yes.
Please.
I think it's a problem with a lot of these European and American visitors as well. I mean, they fly in, they rent a 4x4, and there they go.
Yeah.
I've been on a couple of dune driving trips where I was so surprised where anyone can rock up with a car and go dune driving, and it gets properly dangerous at times.
Like
going 120 down this dune so you can make it up the next one.
Yeah.
And you could have this couple, 65 years old, they woke up in Amsterdam that morning, flew in, got their vehicle... And now they're getting ready to go dune driving. And you just think that this person's not really equipped to do this.
No, they actually told us about that as well. You have a problem, especially with a German tourist. Because, I mean, they're used to driving in Frankfurt, Stuttgart, wherever. Driving on the Autobahn in a 7 Series at 250 kilometers an hour. They can do that easily. But then they get to Africa and they rent... Let's say maybe a Hilux that's been lifted. It's got all the kit.
Nice and leaf rooftop, springs at the back.
Leaf springs at the back. Nice rooftop heavy. Team. Yeah. And then they want to do like the same sort of thing on a gravel road in Namibia. And it just never ends well. But yeah, no, it was good.
And then the steering wheel's on the wrong side.
The gear's
on the wrong side. So it's dangerous.
Yeah. No, it was...
But you guys, other than that one incident, you were fine. No hassles on the roads or anything.
Yeah, nothing really. And the car was skittish on the first day. As I said, that was only tire pressures. The rest was fine. I mean, no issues whatsoever. But we had a guide with us that knew Namibia well and where we could push and where we couldn't. And yeah.
But it was brave of Renault to take them there, I think.
It was insanely brave. If you think about it, it's...
Tough
it's,
environment.
It's a French car.
Which, let's be honest, Romanians. Has a bit of a reputation.
They have a reputation for not being solid or whatever. And they made us do 2,800 kilometers on gravel roads.
And it's sharp and rocky. It's terrible roads. I mean, they're hard on suspensions. It's a nice gravel road, but still you do 2,800 kilometers at 120. That's tough on any vehicle.
Yeah,
and then you've got the heat and the dust. Like, it's really a tough environment.
That is. I have to say that while I was driving that Duster, I did pick up one or two issues, because we've driven that car a few times.
We've done quite a bit of time.
It's a proper good car. I mean, there's no arguing the fact that it's one of the best buys in South Africa at the moment. But spending so much time in it, I did eventually spot a few issues.
Such as?
The Bluetooth mating can be a bit tricky. Like, if you mate your phone and you switch the car off and you switch it back on,
it's not automatic.
Sometimes it will be automatic. Sometimes it just gives up and it absolutely refuses.
But that's such a common problem. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know if Bluetooth is just unstable or whatever.
We've got traction control and so many impressive features on a car, and for some reason the Bluetooth still remains an issue in so many cars. I don't know why.
That was insanely annoying. The other issue is, and this is probably just a French attitude towards car building. You know how the French do it, like the the horn, the button for the horn is not on the steering wheel, so you can bash it South African style and get all your aggression out. It sort of sits on a stalk, and it's a small button. Which, you know,
like
just
the
doesn't.
Fords. I know the Fords used to have that.
Yeah, it doesn't.
My grandmother
you
had an Escort that.
Yeah, I don't like it that way, because it doesn't give you the same sort of relief as you would get from bashing the wheel.
Yeah.
It's sort of like you sit there pushing the small little stupid button. I don't like that.
Bottle up all the anger, leads to all this kind of existential angst.
Yeah, and it's just going nowhere.
That's the problem with the French people, all that existential angst.
Yeah.
Comes from not being able to hoot properly.
Yeah, exactly. And it's got such an unimpressive hooter as us. It just makes like the worst sound ever. It's like, it's not
aggressive
like,
enough.
It doesn't make that noise. It says, get out of my way. It's like, excuse me, could you maybe move? And
if you don't mind,
if you don't
terribly.
Mind. And the other problem is the adjustment, the height adjustment for the lights. We could not find that switch. And on our Duster, the lights were pointing right beneath us. So that first night, we struggled in so badly.
Well, you hit an animal because of that.
Exactly. And then the next day only, after we had to climb in the footwell to find the petrol release cap, we came across this rotary dial that sits at least 30 centimeters below the steering wheel down. Like, there's a rotary knob.
So a bit of an afterthought.
Never be able to see it. Like, and you can just see the French in a meeting going like, oh, we forgot about the horn and we forgot about this dial. Where should
it's not important.
It's not important. We just put it here. And so that was, but it's
so that first night was horrible. Tires too firm,
was,
no lights.
That first night was depressing. And like, you know, 2 hours late, still 500 kilometers to drive on gravel, tired, hungry, because obviously we had a 4 o'clock wake-up call.
Yes, that was a long day.
And, it was a long day, and then you end it by plowing down an innocent animal. It was just bleak, eh? Like,
it was bleak stuff.
Jeez. But the day actually, at 4 o'clock, I have to say this, going through security at Oatambo, I've never seen this in my life. Early morning flight, I had to go through security at around about 4:30. And you get there and all of the desks are open, and every person, it's got a person at every one. But every single one of them, except for one guy, was lying on his arm sleeping. So there was only one customs guy.
Professionalism.
Like, yeah. Oh, man. I love it, yeah.
Well, those are the only issues, those three.
Those three, yeah.
So that's not bad. I mean, those are fairly small, finicky things.
Yeah.
You can live with those.
Yeah, and I'm definitely qualified to comment on the Duster now. I've driven that car. This was my fourth time driving it, and I've driven it properly, good and properly now.
And we've driven it a lot the last month, because we did that trip to Corpse of Whipped.
Yeah, that's coming out in the magazine now, the next edition.
In the July issue.
Yeah.
And it did very well. I was also impressed with it. We didn't do hardcore stuff.
No,
I mean,
no,
most of it
all
was tar driving, but we did a bit of gravel.
No,
and it's an impressive
such a
vehicle.
Car.
If you look at the price range and what else is out there, the other cars tend to be smaller and they tend to not have four-wheel drive at that price. So in that sense, I think it's a good buy. You get four-wheel drive, you get decent size. It's just not probably as well finished off as some of the others.
No, but I can tell you that that interior is well put together. Like, it may not be of the highest quality.
Softest touch materials and that sort of thing, but it's good.
But it's put together solidly. After that many kilometers
in that'll bring out a rattle.
Yeah, no rattles. It was that's a proper car.
Cool. Well, thank you for chatting to us about that.
No problem.
And I suppose we'll be finding out more about Ultimate Briar Master somewhere down the line.
I've been embargoed. I can't really talk about it. Okay. I can't really tell you about the challenge we're part of. All I can tell you is it's the best braai place I ever had in my life.
Oh, really?
Because there was this one pork rib that actually wanted to take it home and introduce it to my family. That's how good it was. I mean,
made by one of the contestants.
Yeah, dude. It was good.
Because you don't even think of a pork chop as braai flesh, really. I mean, no, you don't braai pork.
There was so much to choose from. I mean, there was baba ganoush. One oak actually made milk tart and donuts on a fire on a braai.
There we go.
And I was just like, he's like, do you want some milk tart tonight? Did you make this on a braai? And he was like, yes, sir, we have to do everything on a braai. Obviously, I never saw the show before. I didn't know they have to make everything on a braai.
So did they call you sir?
They were so formal. And, okay. You know, and obviously...
And was this all captured on camera?
Yeah.
So we'll be seeing you in an...
Yeah, you'll be seeing me on wherever Ultimate Braai Master.
You'll be a guest judge.
We weren't guest judges. We were just guests, and they filmed us and our comments or whatever. The judging was still left for the judges.
So whatever you thought of it is completely irrelevant.
Yeah, irrelevant. Like, I think that, we were just supposed to schmooze them, and then the camera came along and took vox pops of what we thought.
Okay.
But, I don't think I'm going to look good because my face was full of fat. I just went next level on all the free food, and that was spectacular. I loved it.
So you were just there to lend it some celebrity.
Yeah. Just be like, show my pretty face there.
Fat-filled face.
Yeah.
Pork chop in one hand, milk tart in the other.
Because after, you know, when we began, we were sort of... you just take a little bit of everything because you think, like, I don't want to look like a pig on camera. But it's so good that after a while you just rub your face in it and I'm not ashamed anymore. And, you know.
Give me more.
Give me more. And I actually had one of the contestants just before they started judging them and decided to throw one of the oaks out. She came up to me and she said, well, she knew I enjoyed those pork ribs immensely. And, she came up all scaly and whatnot. She was like, I can sneak some out for you. And I was like, yes, please do. So
that's so cool.
I rolled away with a few extra, you know, pork ribs. I don't know if that was against the rules or, you know, if you guys are listening.
I'm sure it's fine.
Sorry. It's just they were so good.
They were good.
Yeah. If that person is listening and you get voted out, please come and stay with me. You know, I'll give you a room. Just make those ribs for me every night.
Cool. Well, I think we should briefly chat about something else.
Yes.
The normal Cherokee. New Cherokee. I had a chance to drive it as well.
Yeah.
So let's quickly do a roundup of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say I like it. It's an impressive vehicle.
Yeah, it is, eh?
Like you said, it's really, really good.
Mm.
There's not much fault that you can find with it.
Yeah, you can see it's now a more premium car than ever
Absolutely.
Before. And still, we've got that issue with price because I didn't know this. Gert told me this morning that the previous range, the top spec model was 420,000. You said
a bit more, I think.
A bit more.
Yeah, like 470 or something.
470 for the previous top spec.
And now it starts at around 480.
And now the entry level model starts at 480.
As a completely different market. Now we were actually discussing it earlier because we've got the buyer's guide in the back, and the previous generation we had also look at, for instance, the Freelander and the RAV4. But now the most expensive RAV4 is right at the start of the entry level Cherokee, so it's kind of moved on, and it's in a completely different segment now. So it's competing with proper premium vehicles like an X3,
Q5.
Q5, that sort of thing. So I think that might be a bit of a tough sell. To just swap from one segment to the next like that and convince people that they can buy a Jeep at that price. We're going to have to wait and see. I mean, there's no doubt that it is a phenomenally capable vehicle for what it is. Something like that Trailhawk. I don't think there's another compact SUV that can do what it can do.
No.
Purely because it's got low range gearing, rear diff lock, all of that. But if you look at the price on it, which is just above 700,000 Rand, there's a lot of proper 4x4s you can buy for that price. Like, there's a Fortuner, Pajero Sport, there's so many. So it's going to be a tough sell. I don't know if enough people really want that 4x4 bullet in a compact SUV.
Yeah, it's always difficult to go up against the Germans because we know a lot of a buying decision comes down to what are the neighbors going to think.
Yes.
And
we, like in Europe, we love our German brands.
Exactly.
If someone can afford a German car, they're going to buy a German car.
Exactly.
And it's the same issue that a company like Infiniti, even Lexus has to a certain extent. I mean, if you look at the sales of Toyota and you look at the sales of Lexus, those are so disproportionate. And that's just because people are fine with paying that price for a Toyota, but they're not fine with paying more for a Lexus. If they've got the money, they're going to buy a German car. So it's really tough.
Yeah.
It's an excellent vehicle, but it's going to be a tough sell.
It is competing with the Germans directly now.
It is.
It's rough. It's going to be interesting. Obviously, we haven't received NAMSA figures for the Cherokee yet. Sales have only begun
in June.
Two days ago. And so it's going to be interesting to see round about this time next month how many they sold.
And I suppose there's always like that initial surge of people buying it. So it'll be interesting to see how it does a year from now. Once the market has kind of settled to see if it does well. But I think it's going to be interesting for them.
And you've also now had time to find a few Easter eggs of your own.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I found the one under the seat.
Yeah.
Which I think, I'm not sure what it is. I know there are some coordinates
to on something, those.
And a little Easter egg in the front of the windscreen. But it's cute. It's clever. I mean, it's a nice package. Like you said, there are some nice packing spaces and shelves for oddments. And there's a little space under the seat where you can store things. It's a cleverly thought out vehicle.
Yeah, and that Uconic system is quite good.
It's really, really good.
Yeah, nice and intuitive.
It's a great vehicle, and it's really plush and premium inside. I don't think it's quite like BMW or Merc level, but it's really close.
Yeah,
it is. It might actually be on the same level, but it has a different feel to it. Like I think those German vehicles have a specific feel to their interior. Yeah. And because this is an American brand, it's a little bit different, but it's impressive.
It definitely has more standard features than you'd get in...
Absolutely.
Yeah, because the Cherokee basically comes with everything as standard, whereas in the Germans, everything is basically optional.
Awesome, that's true.
And how are you doing with the fuel consumption so far?
It's not too bad. I mean, it's bad.
Yeah.
It's... But I know you guys were doing like 20 liters per 100 kilometers on road.
Yeah, we were pushing them hard.
When you were at the launch... It's probably around 12.8 to 13 now, which it's done a little bit of highway driving, but not much. So most of it's around town. I think like 12, 13 is probably going to be your average, which is high for a compact SUV.
Yeah, that car needs a diesel.
That's really thirsty. I don't know how many people are going to be all right with that. But it is a pricey car. I mean, if you can pay 700,000 Rand for it, maybe it's not an issue. But it's just a bit odd to find a compact SUV. It's not a big vehicle, so it's disproportionately thirsty.
It needs that diesel option because all of its competitors
have the diesel.
Offer the diesel option,
and apparently there is a diesel in the UK and in Europe.
Yeah.
I told you about it, but you said they told you there isn't a diesel option coming soon.
Diesel option coming soon. It may be an issue of. Just our fuel quality.
That's what I was thinking as well.
Because, over there, they now have 10 and 5 ppm diesel. Its engine may be tuned for those.
Because it looks like a nice engine. I think it's a 2-liter diesel, and it's got two states of tune. The one is just over 100 kilowatt, and then there's like 100 and 130 or 140 kilowatt option as well.
Mm.
So that would be a very nice engine. Probably has nice torque on it as well. So let's hope they bring that in. I think if you mate that to the 9-speed auto,
it'd
be lovely to drive.
Mm.
But it's an excellent vehicle. I'm impressed with it. I'm certainly enjoying driving it.
Mm.
And we've got the road test coming up in the July issue.
Yeah.
So you can have a look at that. So I think let's wrap it up for today. Thank you so much for telling us about your trip. And we'll chat again soon.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.